Trust everybody had a thankful holiday with their loved ones in and so forth. I know we did. It's really great to have Callie and Kendra up from and down from wherever they live. I hope all of you had the same experience. Yeah, I guess this mic's working just fine. I can hear it. So this morning I had I thought we'd start with what's in the headlines this week. It'll lead me into where I want to go. Iran signed a nuclear agreement. And that's the ambassador to the UN from Iran there. So does that mean peace and safety for all, right? No. You guys got that out of the Bible then, huh?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What about the next headline here? Greece unemployment rates stood at an alarming level of 27% of September, tops in the Eurozone. After Spain, which had an unemployment rate of 26%, the next closest was Portugal at 16.3, according to Facts Research. According to the WHO report, health care and access has declined due to a 40% hospital cuts in budget. An estimated 26,000 public health workers, including 9,100 doctors, are expected to lose their jobs. That's pretty bad over there, as you can expect. But they tell us things are going to get better. In Greece, according to the WHO report, suicide soared 17% in Greece between the years 2007 and 2009. And then another 25% in 2010. The crisis deepened in the first half of 2011 with suicide attempts surged 40%. Moreover, the WHO report said that HIV rates have risen significantly. And estimates that about half the new AIDS infections are self-infliction, to enable people to receive benefits of 700 euros per month and faster administration to drug substitution programs. Can you imagine that? Things are so bad that half the people that have AIDS virus are doing it themselves. That's pretty bad. Give yourself AIDS so you can get $700 a month. Any takers? This was in the early part of the week, the 26th. The Pope's new bold vision. The Pope on Tuesday called for big changes in the Roman Catholic Church, including at the very top, saying the church needs to rethink rules and customs that are no longer widely understood or effective for evangelizing. You got to understand where this guy came from. He's a Jesuit. The Jesuit order was established to stop the backslide of the Protestants. They were to cut off and stop the falling away of Catholics, and that's how the Jesuits were started. And this is the first Jesuit we have for a pope. So he's going to stop this backsliding. The Pope also hinted that he wants to see an end to the so-called wafer wars in which Catholic politicians who support abortion rights are denied the Holy Communion. In other words, anybody, and a lot of priests out there, feeling that a politician was promoting abortion rights would stop them from having the sacrament. This Pope is going to allow them to have sacrament again. His comments could be also taken another sign that the plans to reform the church rules that prevent divorce in Catholics from receiving the sacrament. So he's also going to allow, up until this point, if you were divorced, and remarried, you weren't allowed to have a sacrament, that's going to change. Everyone can share in some way in the life of the church. Everyone can be part of the community, nor should the doors of the sacrament be closed for simply any reason. We need to create still broader opportunities for more incisive female presence in the church, the Pope said. In September, the Pope Francis said the church has the right to express its opinions, but not to interfere spiritually in the lives of gays and lesbians. Who am I to judge? You know, it's, they're going to broaden the way. They're going to make it easier to become a Catholic. They're going to make it easier for Protestants to sign more agreements to join their church. Pope Francis, this was a couple of months ago, Pope Francis is warning the Catholic Church that moral edifice might fall like a deck of cards if it does not balance its divisive rules about abortion, gays, and contraceptives with a greater need to make the church a merciful, more welcoming place for all. And it will be. It will be made, changes will be made to incorporate the Protestants, to have a more liberal agenda. And they'll make these changes probably as early as this spring to incorporate more members. I'm kind of tipping my hand here. Who thinks the Catholic Church is going to get smaller? They are not. They are not. They grew 75 million. About the, in just this year, 75, what is it, about a quarter of the population of the United States, they grew in just this year by incorporating several of the Protestant groups that are now part of the Universal Church. I wanted to start with our brother where he left off on the Thanksgiving last week. He had a Thanksgiving service and a prayer service. So I wanted to kind of lead off with one of his scriptures. James 1, 6 through 8. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. He's not saying that we shouldn't expect those things. He's talking about a wavering. You know, I used to have, not trouble, but trouble understanding. You know, how can a person help if his faith is weak? And I used to say, how can we help what we believe? And I've searched for that many years, and I've came to, I'm happy that I understand that now. If your faith is weak, it means your desire or your hope is weak. You don't have a proper desire. It means that or your labor is weak. You're not laboring in the gospel. Many scriptures talk about exercising our faith, and if we're not exercising that faithfulness, our faith will be weak. Another reason it might be weak is we're not studying the scriptures, because these scriptures that I have here prove the gospel to anybody that is an open mind. So it's one of those three things. So we have no excuses for weak faith. And that's why he can come down hard in James to say if our faith is weak. And he'll reject us if our faith is weak. Heilman's. I'm sorry, I don't have a lot of scriptures to turn to because I have a lot of slides here. But let us read this one. The angel said unto me that many shall see greater things than these, to the intent that they might believe that these signs and wonders and should come to pass upon all the face of the land, to the intent that there should be no cause for unbelief on the children of men. The scriptures are given prophecy. The main reason scriptures are given is that we believe. You know, it's a proof to us. Those that are searching the scriptures, you know, when we have these prophecies before us and we see them come to pass, it should be, if our hearts are right, a testimony to us to believe these things, to have a confidence. And as we grow in the gospel, we know these things are true. That's the purpose. That's what they're telling us here. He gives us these signs, you know, and I remember the scripture, and I think it's Matthew, where this guy, he's died, and one went to one place, one to the other, and he wanted to go back and tell his relatives about this, that they have to believe. And he says, even if you go back, they are not going to believe. They're not going to be a follower, no matter what signs you give them. We believe what we want to believe. 1 Nephi 3, 191. And after it had come forth unto them, I beheld other books, which came forth by the power of the Lamb. From the Gentiles unto them, unto the convincing of the Gentiles, and the remnant of the seed of thy brethren, and also the Jews, which were scattered upon the face of the earth, that the records of the prophets of the 12 apostles were true. That this Bible is true. That's what they're saying. The second record is to tell us that this first record is true. And we're to believe it. And we're to follow it. You know, each of those cases I gave you this morning, you know, the bad economy. Do we think the economy's going to be great in the future and that it's going to be peace and prosperity, no wars? Those things that we showed you? You don't believe those things. You believe what the scriptures have to say, and you have a faith in it. Because why? You've seen things in the past. They always come true. Every time. And we have a faith in that. We can have a confidence in that. What about this one, though? These books come forth, it calls. And they're going to be used from the Gentiles. And we've told you for years, we're going to carry this gospel forth unto the Gentiles, the remnant of the seed of the brethren, Placido's group, for instance, and the Jews. And they are going to believe the gospel. Do we believe that? It says it right here. But do we really believe it? You know, some of us waver on these points. And they shouldn't be wavering. You know, there's many proofs of the Bible in the Book of Mormon. I'm going to give you a few today. For the time cometh, 1 Nephi 3, 2.14 and 2.6 through 2.16. The time cometh, saith the Lamb, that I will work a great and marvelous work among the children of men. A work that shall be everlasting, either on the one hand or the other. Either the convincing them of peace and life eternal, or unto the deliverance unto them to the hardness of their hearts and the blindness of their minds, and being brought down to the captivity unto destruction, both temporally and spiritually, according to the captivity of the devil, of which I have spoken. Do we believe that? It's telling us this gospel is going to go forth. And it's going to convince. And it's going to be a marvelous work and a wonder, either one way or the other. You know, do we believe that? You know? That's the question. Are we wavering on these points? Isaiah 52:15. Therefore my people shall know my name, therefore they shall know in that day that I am he that doeth speak. Behold, it is I. The Lord has made his bare arm holy, his holy arm in the eyes of the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of God. It's talking about a day where the house of Israel is going to come to know Jesus Christ. You know, there was a point in the history, over 1,000 years, that the nations, the churches, did not believe that the house of Israel were going to come to the Lord. They didn't believe it. There's still 85% of Christians that don't believe it. But they're going to see it. He's going to show them. And that's what he's talking about. Make his arm bare. They're going to see it. So that they shall sprinkle many nations, and the kings shall shut their mouths at him. For that which they have not been told, they shall see, and that which they have not heard, they shall consider. Even though they haven't heard it before, they're going to consider it when they see this great conversion to Jesus Christ. Who's going to do that work? Scriptures are clear who's going to do that work. His church. The one that's called by his name. The one that has his gospel. The one who has his works. The nation, the church that first believed that Israel would be a nation again. Critics, there is no proof ever was a King David. You know, they probably still say that. You know, there was no, you know, you can't take history without, you know, the Bible, for instance. If you do away with that, it leaves it pretty scarce, even King David in the Bible, to prove. And critics will say, that was a, you know, King David never lived. These are fantasies. This Bible is a fantasy, is what they'll say. That's what critics said. They're becoming fewer. Ancient relics are the first definite sign the Bible's King David. And this is in 2012. They found a relic before that, I remember it. It talked about a David, but it wasn't really convincing. But now they found more relics. That David was not a mythical figure. There's evidence of a biblical King David. Ruins had banned this place that they found. The ruins had banned on graven images. They outlawed them. And finds strength in the idea of a biblical history, the find does. I don't think any of us here had any doubt that there was a King David, that the story of the Bible was true. But critics will say that, you know. You'll find plenty of naysayers, but, you know, there's proofs. If anybody's really looking, there's proofs to all of these things. And most of the proofs have came forth this year. And most of the ideas that I'm going to present to you, you know, 100 years ago, the proof wasn't there. And they had to take it on real faith. Today, we don't, you know, if you look at the proofs, you don't really need that much faith. You shouldn't be wavering with all the proofs that we have. And here's a few more. Critics, the sword is common knowledge that swords, such as those described in Alma, did not exist in Mesoamerica prior to the arrival of the Spanish conquistadors. Said they didn't exist. But, you know, they found this axe head here. They found these pictures here. And, you know, these ones, that these pictures here on the right, on your left, They used obsidian, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with obsidian, but this black rock you found in volcanoes, and they used it for their knives and their hatchets, and of course they used it for, we found an arrowhead when we were down in Yucatan. They used it for their arrowhead, and the picture there is they tied them to these sticks, and they have a double wielding sword is what they wield. And they cut you up pretty good. And they're more sharp than our present-day steel. In fact, they use them in our some surgeons use them today, the obsidian, instead of knives, because it's sharper. Alma. They had only their swords, their scimitars, their bows and their arrows and their stones and their slings, but they were naked, save over their skin, where they were girded about their loins, yea, they were naked, save the Zoramites and the Amalekites. And as you can see the picture there, that's not a made-up picture, that's actually one they found. You can see how they were dressed, the Lamanites. And they got cut to pieces, as this one guy that's laying there shows, because they didn't cover their skin. Their shields and their sort of broad swords and two-handed swords were set about with flints and cut much better than our swords. And that's a book that's out, just came present in 1963. In most all these references you're going to see here, they're not restoration sources. These are outside sources. So they did have swords. In fact, you know, I was at a museum in the lower part of the Yucatan where the Tree of Life is at, right at the very bottom there, and I can't... Itza, I think is the name of the site. And I went to this museum, and they had all these metal workings and all these swords. And I asked them, what was the time period for these swords? Because you don't hear much about metal. And they said, oh, it's the same as the other stuff. Well, the other stuff was dating back to the time of Christ. All these swords dating back to the time of Christ, according to the museum there. So you don't hear much about that. Critics. Metal plates. There are snow-sitch records engraving upon golden plates, or any other plates in the early ages. That was a quote from 1887. The next one, in 1920. It does not seem how I've been pointing out to the youth that the gold will corrode if left in the earth for a number of years, and the plates were supposed to have been buried. In other words, the guy is saying, you know, Joseph didn't understand that gold can't preserve if you have written records on it. Wrong they were. Wrong they are. You know, since that time, many, many gold plates, or many plates of metal, for that matter, have been found. Here's one in a box. And I got most of these from... Chris has a lot of these online on our church website now. I pulled a lot of these from there. Gold or brass or copper plates. And they're numerous. And I didn't put them all here because, like I say, they're numerous. But here's the samples. And you'll notice the one there that with the gold rings. That's much the same. And dates to about the same time as the Book of Mormon. Actually, 600 B.C. when they first started putting the metal rings and pounding the gold out. Critics. Elephants. Even Joseph Smith should have known that there were no elephants in America. And they also had horses and asses and were elephants, and I don't know what the other two are, and all were useful unto man. And that dates from the time before the Nephites got there. That's the group, the Jaredites. I don't know if there's a mention. I should have looked in the as long as ago as the Nephites. But they were on this land. What the scientists say, though, on those things right there, they say that those are actually parrots. They look like parrots to you? Yeah, me either. Here's a few more parrots for you to look at. And these came from Mayan ruins. They knew about elephants. They weren't the Jaredite people that put these up. They were the Nephites. Critics. Horses. Many scientists believe that horses did not exist in America prior to the arrival of Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus was thought to bring them all there. Or, you know, I'm sure this is more recent. I can't imagine a scientist that doesn't know that there was horses in this country. I mean, you can go to Luray and look at hundreds of them if you want to. You know, they're buried. They are in the tar pits. They're preserved. So any scientist that said that isn't much of a scientist. Now, there's a few, the scientists today at Luray will say they became extinct around 10,000 B.C., some 9,000 years before the Nephites. We did a time study. Most of you believe what? When was Adam born? Most of you believe, right? It was, what, 4,000 years B.C.? So they say that there was no horses in the time of man. Adam, anyway. Of course, they don't believe that Adam was... they believe much farther back than that. But let's see. Medusa. Enos. And it came to pass that people of Nephi did till the land and raise all manner of grain and fruit and flocks of the herd and flocks of all manner of cattle and every kind and goats and wild goats and many horses. It sounds here, I'll give you that most of the horses sound like they were raised like cattle and probably maybe as a food source. Most of us don't want to think about that. But they did ride a few, at least the kings. But it looks like most of them were used for for cattle. Is there any proof of this? Chris, you got this picture. You got the better one, I think, from me. Didn't you at conference? Yeah, I thought you got the better one. But if I had the better one, I'd show you. This is the guy with the beard here. You can see the outline here. And there's a horse in the background. The ones below, I guess scientists didn't know about these. They're all pictographs of horses. Or maybe they're dogs, I don't know. They look like horses to me. It's a big dog, that guy that's standing there, that's a dog. Critics, the wheel. It is generally accepted that the belief that ancient Mesoamerica never developed the use of the wheel. What do you think? Book of Mormon says different. And now that the king had commanded his servants, previous to the time to the watering of their flock, they should prepare their horses and chariots and conduct him forth unto the land of Nephi. So we find an instant that the king had a chariot. No chariots, said the experts. It's funny, on the picture of the right, the kings had, the children had a knowledge how to make these wheels and toys and chariots. But their fathers, this must be a kid. This must be a kid on the left because the scientists tell us that the adults didn't know how to do a wheel. Skin problems. No evidence that during the Book of Mormon times in Mesoamerica that any skin changed colors or that there was ever a history of conflict between peoples of different skin colorizations. No problem, or no skin colorizations, no evidence whatsoever, as they'll tell you. Well, history is being written. Besides Columbus, Cortez found white Indians imprisoned in Montezuma's palace in Mexico. George Vancouver, thank you. Saw them in Vancouver Island, and I guess they'll name the island for him, in 1792. The commander of Stills in the American Navy claimed he'd seen the same group in 1848. Humboldt saw about 100 of them in Colombia in 1801. White Indians have been reported among the Mandan tribe along the banks of the Mississippi. And one of the first books ever published on Native American women, to the American Indian, Reminiscence of the Yukon Woman. She devoted her entire chapter, the works entitled Traditions of the Ancient White People. Non-restoration sources, all of these. And you know, I went online and looked for that once, you know, and they do still exist to this day. There's a certain area that there's white Indians. Their blood, you know, there's white, and they're not mixed with Europeans, if you will, and they're white still to this day. How about archaeology? What does that say for us? Here's just a few of the pictures that are available out there. This top one, they aren't truly that black. They're putting on black skins. These are Lamanites, and they're doing it for a ceremony. And you notice that it appears the white one, the whiter of the bunch, are kneeling down. It looks like to be some ceremony that they were talking about things past, that the whiter ones would worship the blacker ones. The pictures down below, it shows a conflict between the black ones, the darker ones and the white ones. And it is the picture on the right. Two colors of skin. Conflict. And you'll notice that, you know, this is my last picture I'm going to show, but they're showing a conflict. And almost every time you can look at the pictures there, the one on your left, lower, and almost always this guy on the very far left bottom is going to get skewered, the white one. And almost all the pictures you'll see with a white and a black, it's always the white ones are servient to the blacks, or they're getting sheared. The white Indian here is taking a ride in the very top. But they're always getting defeated in the murals. Critics, it was common knowledge that the ancient Mesoamericans did not use cement in their architecture. Did not use cement. That's what our experts have to say. Helaman. The people who went forth became exceedingly experts in the workings of the smith. We have a conflict here. Smith appears in many places. You can read them. And we've been to most, we've been to all these places, and we'll tell you there is cement in every one of these places, and some you're not mentioning. Guatemala City, for one, is built by cement. Here's a picture of just one place they'll show you. Look between those rocks. How do you think they put them together? It wasn't sand that those rocks. They aren't boulders. These are stones. They use cement, and these are all cement establishments. So much for the experts again. One critic out there, and he's very famous now. He took an attack against the Book of Mormon and the Mormons in particular. Indigenous peoples in Americas are not related to modern Jews, but came across the land bridge from Asia around 10,000 BC. Smithsonian probably supports that view, but they didn't do it genealogy-wise. These guys, this was the guy, I can't remember his name, but he did it through DNA, is what he said. The Popol Vuh, another ancient book, it came forth prior to the Book of Mormon coming forth. And prior, it was written prior to the Spanish coming to this land. Popol Vuh. It was the Quiche. Authors wrote about the contents were based on an ancient book that came across the sea from the east. That's where they came from. They said, we came across from the east. Not from the land bridge, we came from the east. That's what their book says. Authors refer to the ancient book upon the Popol Vuh as being based on the meaning of instrument of light or vision. That's where it came forth. And it was based, you know, it means a clear stone is how they came forth. The word is used today to refer to a clear quartz in crystals that the Quiche priest would use as religious ceremonies. Anybody heard of that before? Clear stones to read the priest. The Jews had them for years. They were called the Urim and Thummim. Just skim over some of these. They talked about these guys, said it was impossible that they didn't have any DNA to reflect. Well, they found it now. And some of the Native Americans founders were Caucasian ancestry. A brief communications. This is the one that one guy came out and said they don't have any X in the ancient Americans. Well, they've confirmed they do have it, and not all of them. And you know, that's the thing. We don't know how many of the Jaredites were not killed, We don't know how many people came across the land bridge. We never said, the Book of Mormon doesn't, they say they came across 10,000 years ago. The Book of Mormon doesn't even talk about 10,000 years ago. You know, the Jaredite people were maybe 2,200 BC. The Nephites were 600 AD. They don't talk about any of the people coming across the land bridge. They don't rule it out. So, that some came across, I have no doubt that they did. But it says they found this X, and this X is not related to the Europeans, if you will. It's a certain area. Our characteristics, let me see. Evidence that DNA is passed on by their mothers only is supplemented by the evidence of the Y chromosome and is passed on by their fathers only. A little dry. Native Americans' Y chromosomes show a variety of this haplogroups, including 4 and 1C, which are characteristics of the Jewish people. And I wanted to get to this one. This X that we're talking about, yeah, let me see. To their surprise, however, this number X is only confirmed in the genes of smattering of limited living people in Europe and Asia Minor, including Italians, Finns, and certain Israelis. Regarding the recent discovery of a small group in Siberia with this X, the recent work confirms the statement made indicating that this number X DNA in America is not directly related to the usual little pocket of the X DNA in Siberia. Where it comes from is what they're telling you is the area in the green there. All these studies. This is where this people that came to United States and Central America, indigenous Americans. This is the group right there. And as you'll notice, that far left of that green spot, that's Israel. And up above that is where they really say it came from the area of Turkey, Assyria. It's the place that they were pulled away in 720 BC. That was the area that Joseph's seed came from. They were pulled away. Remember those tribes, the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, they were pulled away to Assyria. That's where they're saying this group came from. That's directly where they came from. And that's exactly where they would, the author here, are not related to Native Manic clusters, but they are more likely explaining the recent gene flow from Europe, from the West Asia. And that's the area right there. A little dry, I know. But what's coming forth is the people are identified to come from that area. You know, in the studies that they used, that when they said these American Indians aren't part of the Jewish clan, they tested some Jews and they says, okay, they're not related, and because they don't have this gene that you're now finding. But you know, they test these Jews that they have with the Kolin group that over in Kohan group over in Africa and other groups around, and they say they're not related either. Something's wrong. Something's fishy. When they say that all these Jewish groups, well, they're not really related either. How can they not be? Of course, you know, the Jews, they say, you know, they wouldn't marry outside, especially the Levitical ones, they wouldn't marry outside of their clan, if you will. They stayed together and they lived together and they shared the land mass with their relatives and they had lands. So they didn't travel much outside of the area. So that would probably explain that they're not related to another. But it shows you that if somebody came forth and said, oh, they're Cohen, if they really wanted to say, well, they would say, well, they're not even cousins. They're not related to another. As far as we're concerned, we know differently. All right, last one on that. We find that, I'm skipping down here, we find that M242 scattered all over Central Yerusha, and centralized in Turkey, just above Iran. The 10 tribes, including Manasseh, were taken captive into Media, northern Iran. And that's where they found this group X, if you will, people came from. Right where they're supposed to have come from, when they were taken away. And we don't know how Joseph's clan came back, but many of them did. Not most of them, but many came back and settled after the, you know, after the years that they were defeated. Remember, the Assyrians were also defeated, but some of them came back, and Joseph's group obviously came back because they left out of Israel. All right. Something a little easier to follow. Alma 144. In the abundance of flocks and herds and fatlings of every kind, and also the abundance of grain and of gold and of silver and precious things, in the abundance of silk and fine linen. What do the critics say? I also like to point out that there could not have been silk in Mesoamerica either. Well, there's a number of books out now that talk about that. 1967 and so forth. Silk from insect cocoons was spun into the cloth in ancient Mesoamerica. Silk, like fibers, were harvested from the silk cotton from the tree of Yucatan. Another book, cloth was woven from the Pita Flora silk grass. All right. Next criticism, all alleged this grievous error. Even from the child should they know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. How could Joseph Smith in 1829 have blundered so? You know, I get faced with this one sometimes. And I bring some books like this one here. And the second part of that in Alma. Let me read it. And behold, he shall be born of Mary in Jerusalem, which shall be the land of our forefathers. And then you can read 39 times that it came to pass that when he had come into the land of Jerusalem. And, you know, they're still teaching this one today. I got it twice while I've been overseas. You know, it says land of Jerusalem. What are they talking about? That doesn't say that in the Bible. It's never referred to the land of Jerusalem. What are they talking about? That's obviously an error. And that he came from the Jerusalem. That's an error, they point out. Well, not so much. You know, there's a couple of books, the Armenian Letters and the Dead Sea Scrolls. They both teach the land of Jerusalem. And I carry this little thing around. And I bring the Dead Seas with me, you know, when I was getting these questions. And I point out in the Dead Sea, it says, see, it says land of Jerusalem there. And it says, you know, before that time, Dead Seas are 200 AD. Before that, you turn to this one. And I bring this nice map out, and I bring the letters that talk about that. And I says, it mentions the land of Jerusalem. And not only that, it probably is probably referring to Bethlehem there, being among the land of Jerusalem. And the land of Jerusalem was this big area right around Jerusalem, including Bethlehem. And it's been that way always. We can't help it if the Bible doesn't mention it. History books do. That was known as the land of Jerusalem. And instead of being a negative thing, it has turned out to be a great proof. You know, and I'll bring out these things and I say, okay. Three days of darkness. I get this one a lot. And I usually, they bring up this. They probably haven't even read it, but they've heard some negative things. And they say, how come in the scriptures it says 3 hours of darkness or thereabouts, and in the Book of Mormon it says 3 days? And I bring out a couple of pictures and I say, well, those are the pictures. You can barely see it because it's so dark. I says, in this recent storm in New Zealand, you know, when this volcano erupted, how many days was it dark here in your land? And he says, well, it wasn't dark here. I says, why not? It was dark over New Zealand for a long time, you know, over 24 hours, I think a couple of days. Why was, and that's just one volcano. How come it wasn't dark here? Well, we didn't have the volcano here. And I say, obviously. You know, there was volcanoes going off left and right in Guatemala, no doubt. There was, today, this very day, there's probably two or three that are going off. But they were exploding back then. You had great destruction. The land was black because of these, you know, you had cities being buried. And you had others growing on fire. How does a city go on fire? Especially with most of its rock, you know? You know, there is obviously volcanic activity. And just one volcano, you know, is responsible for 3 days of darkness. Just imagine 20 or 30 of them going off. And I'll just quickly go over this because my time is at hand. You know, this is the, they've discovered all these volcanoes. And every one of these date to 30 AD or the time of Christ. And this is a big one in the northern part of where Mexico City is at. This is more in the Tres Zapatos. In Tres Zapatos, Zapotes. You know, there's a picture of it down below where those two, you know, we know that these are the areas that the not only the Nephites were destroyed, but also that's the culture before the Jaredites. And you can see that guy doesn't look anything like a Nephite. But that's the previous ones, the Jaredites, that was their king. You can find all those stone statues. But that's the area we're talking about. And they found that these cities in that area was the ash in the layer of question would read, they found the last stela, if you will, that was buried, read 31 BC. So sometime after that, there was a large volcano. And that buried that entire land. And I think that's AD. Actually, if I'm not mistaken. The next area was the area of ash. Around the time of Christ, it says, a 3,000 area mile. 30 to 35 foot of volcanic ash fell around the time of Christ. And that was around the area of El Salvador. And El Salvador is right in the heart of where the Nephites and Lamanites were, mainly the Lamanites. And that's 35 feet of volcanic ash, and it ranged from 30,000 miles, 3,000 square miles, at the time of Christ. And I'll point out also, this geologist that's publishing this is not an LDS member. They're not from our restoration. And then finally, and there's one that did ice core samples, and they found ice core samples in the far north that show they're from the Guatemala area. There was a huge, huge volcanic eruption. They're finding it in the ice core samples between 30 and 40 AD, all the time of Christ. And I'll just point out one last one here. These are north of that, and we go up to Idaho Reunion. And you're going to find mile after mile, it looks like the landscape of the moon. You won't find any vegetation. You just see these volcanic rocks for mile after mile after mile. As far as the eye can see, just mounds of this volcanic ash. And you read the inscriptions, when did the last one take place? Around 30 AD. So across all of America was developed in these volcanic activity at 30 AD. The name Alma, they'll tell you that the name Alma is at the time of Joseph Smith had in the book. They says he must have pulled that from the Old Testament, from this name Shal Alma Nazara, because it was obviously a girl's name at that time. There's no mention of an Alma in the Bible. Where did he get the name? He must have stole it from the Bible and just took it part of that name. Not so much. In 1961. They found names of the Bible, and after that part time, 1975, they found it throughout that area where they came from. So instead of making them a name, they've actually now, it's a great proof for us. And you shouldn't hear anybody You know, if anybody says Alma was not a name back then, you know, there's lots of proof out there now, and they're just giving you another proof that this name wasn't invented. Then, 3 Nephi 9:71, then shall the Father gather them together again and give them unto Jerusalem the land of their inheritance. When this was published in 1829, it was we knew that, and even before that, that in the 1820s, that the Jerusalem would be inhabited again with the house of Israel. It doesn't sound like it's a great thing today, but back then we were cutting new ground. Nobody believed that. Nobody. You know, there might have been some individuals, but absolutely no churches went out and published that. They believed that Israel was dead. Replacement theology reigned supreme. The history, premillennialism, began to die out with the establishment of the Catholic Church during the time of Augustine. This is not Church of Christ propaganda. This is coming out of the, you know, this is a LDS, a non-Church of Christ member that's publishing this. The Catholic Church is when premillennialism, that's where they gave up the idea of the idea of a thousand-year reign. That's where they gave up the idea that that the Jews would come forth, that Jerusalem would be inhabited again with the Jews. The Church of Christ came forward and says, no, that's not true. And here they say 85% of the mainline Christian churches are now embracing replacement theology. That means Jews don't have a home. They will not come to Christ. That's what it teaches. Few, if any, have noted, though, that the Zionism and dispensationalist Christianity both came from the scene practically at the same time in the later part of the 19th century. That's not true. That came forth in 1830 with the establishment of the Church of Christ. That's when it came forward. We brought that forth. Not some 50 or 70 years later. It came forth in 1830. We also knew because of this and others, it came to pass that it saith unto me, look and behold the great abominable church, which is the mother of all abominations, who the father is the devil. And he saith unto me, there shall save be two churches only. We know that's coming to pass. And one is the Church of the Lamb and one is the devil. These bodies of Protestants that came out are going to go back in. We know that. Is Francis the first pope? I gave this slide a week ago. Is Francis the first Protestant pope? Is this the face of the first Protestant pope? And the answer is yes. No doubt about it. He's become now the Pope of the Christian Reformed Churches in America, the Presbyterian, the Reformed, the Roman Catholic Church signed it also, of course, the United Church of Christ. Some 75 million, he is now the first Pope. Why do I say that? Together we affirm that they incorporated into the universal church by baptism. Whether you're baptized in the Reformed Church or you're baptized in the Catholic Church, you are now a member of that body. It's called the Universal Church. Another name for that is Catholic Church. You're a member. And all you have to do to take sacrament in the other one is that you have to send your membership over to the Catholic Church. Together we affirm the validity of baptism depends on the celebration according to the apocalyptic witness by the church and its authority and ministers. In a nutshell, they receive each other's baptisms, they receive each other's authority. Okay? And this is not the first, okay, but it's the first of many. Okay, I'm about done here. All these, we're talking about faithfulness. Each one of these, and I start thinking about this, and each one of these stories here, and yes, it's true, each one of these you'll find are examples of great faithfulness. I wasn't pointed to bring this out, but now I look at these, and none of them are ministers of Jesus Christ. None of them were called to the office of an elder. None of them were called to any offices. And they brought thousands. They saved Israel many times from bloodshed. They saved them from, saved thousands of Christians. They brought many into Jesus Christ, thousands, many of them. And not one of them was a minister. They are showing their faith. They are showing their faithfulness. And none of them were ministers. And that's who the Lord can use. And I don't think I'll turn to it because I've taken too much time. But it tells us in the days to come that this gospel will be taken forth among the Gentiles. That first scripture I wrote you, read to you. The Gentiles are going to be converted. The land of Americas is going to be converted. And also the Jews are going to be converted. And that's what the scriptures tell us. There are, you know, I've just scratched the surface this morning about the proofs that already exist in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. And they're numerous. And, you know, they're just overwhelming. And that thing that it tells us that we're going to take this word forth and it's going to convert the whole world, you shouldn't have any doubt of that. And we have to be faithful unto those. You know, all those guys that we just showed, you know, they weren't told by God to do that. They weren't told by God that they were going to be, their lives were going to be saved. Not a one. What they were told is, they weren't told anything. They says, I will stand. You know, the Nephite, the Abednego and Meshach and Abednego, those guys there, they says, you know, you can do what you want. We're going to stand for Christ. You know, we don't care if you kill us or not. That's faith. That's faithfulness. And that's the faith we have to have going forward. You know, these things are true. And if you don't believe it, then there's something wrong with your faithfulness. You're not doing something because the proofs are overwhelming and they're there. And it's going to happen. The only question is, are we going to be a part of it? Because it's going to happen. I thank you for your time. Sorry, I ran a little bit over. Brother Chris?